Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of one of seven Dhamma talks and Sangha discussions from our fall 2017 retreat at Mon Dharma Center in Claverack, New York, from October 19th to October 22nd. Information about future retreats can be found at becoming-buddha.com. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So the setting is thus. It's about 6 weeks post the Buddha's awakening, about 4 weeks since he gave his first teaching. And now there's about 1,000 folks ready to hear what the Buddha has to say. During that time in northern India, southern Nepal, there was a lot of different cults that were into different types of worship and sacrifice. Human and animal sacrifice was common. And there was a rather famous cult that worshipped fire. And the Buddha used them as a metaphor for this teaching and how we develop worship of objects that we become clinging to as they contact our senses. And we literally create a type of worship about these things. So the Buddha was staying at Gaya, at Gaya Head, with about 1,000 monks, and there he addressed those monks. Monks, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with a fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion, the fire of the three defilements. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, regrets, pains, distresses, and despair, meaning a flame with dukkha. The ear is a flame, sounds are a flame. The nose is a flame, aromas are a flame. The tongue is a flame, flavors are a flame. Meaning the result of contact just continues the inflammation of the senses. The body is a flame, tactile sensations are a flame. The intellect is a flame. Ideas are a flame. And how we love our ideas, don't we, and our ideology. Consciousness at the intellect is a flame. Contact at the intellect is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, regrets, pains, distresses, and despairs. Seeing clearly, the well-instructed disciple grows disenchanted with the eye. What an incredibly powerful statement. Disenchanted now with the things that we used to, the same organ, the same sense that we used to use to inflame ourselves and distract ourselves, we now are becoming disenchanted when we become well-instructed by the noble teachings. A flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, regrets, pains, distresses, and despairs. Seeing clearly, the well-instructed disciple grows disenchanted with the eye. They grow disenchanted with forms. They grow disenchanted with consciousness at the eye. They grow disenchanted with contact at the eye. We were talking before about the sense organs should be just as impersonal as the heart organ. It's just another bodily function. But when we have a self-referential view of the world, that we're using our senses to continually reaffirm that, the senses become that organ of inflammation, don't they? And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too they grow disenchanted. They grow disenchanted with the ear. They grow disenchanted with the nose. They grow disenchanted with the tongue. They grow disenchanted with the body. They grow disenchanted with the intellect. They grow disenchanted with ideas. They grow disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect, and they grow disenchanted with contact at the intellect. So that those misinformed tools that we use to keep ourselves in delusion are no longer in effect. In the previous sutta, I talked about the estrangement that we develop to form feeling perceptions, etc. It's the same thing. We're not familiar with this way of being anymore. We've abandoned it completely. And whatever there is that arises in contact at the intellect, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they grow disenchanted with that too. Process. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge, I'm fully released. We know it. We're no longer ignorant of what's occurring. They discern, birth is ended, the integrated or the holy life fulfilled, the task is done. There is nothing further for this world. This is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, the hearts and minds of the 1,000 monks, through no clinging being sustained, were fully released from all fermentations and the effluence and defilements. That's the end of the sutta. Addressing the problem directly in the way that the Buddha taught, we recognize the foolishness of our own engagement with trying to maintain a self-referential ego self, and we simply become disenchanted with the entire process. Disenchanted, we let it go. And it really is that simple and direct. It takes the understanding that's developed through the Dhamma and directly through the Eightfold Path to become disenchanted. But the end result is a gentle relinquishment of everything that's troubling in our lives. We simply let it go because we recognize the valueless in all of it. And upon hearing that, the 1,000 monks...
1,016.
That's that. In the context of what we learned, that's a pretty powerful but simple explanation of how to develop the Dhamma, isn't it? Becoming disenchanted with the things that we were once so enchanted with, we created identities over them. Remarkable. Any questions on the sutta? Any comments on the sutta? Really?
Well, I can identify to a lot of it. I mean, I am disenchanted with a lot of stuff that I was enchanted with before. So,
what's that experience like? Sorry, you open your mouth now, aren't you?
It's a new thing to get used to. It's new to me, in as much as I can be taken aback a bit, but just not needing stuff that I used to need, and it kind of takes you back, it rocks you back a bit. It's new to me. And that can be a little unsettling, although in the big picture we're going in the right direction, but at the time when you actually are conscious of things that you're not thinking about, things like you used to think about them before, it's a little unsettling and a little disturbing.
Yeah.
That's the immediate sort of negative to it, but obviously,
yeah, keep your eye on the big picture, on understanding that what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
oftentimes the aha moments are followed by that unsettled. Mark and I had a discussion about that. And if you want to talk about it, I'm not prodding it too. The unnerving, unsettled nature of it is the unraveling of the ego self. And there's a loss of equilibrium often during that time, you know, because we're going from one identity that we're very familiar with to something, to an identity that we're completely unfamiliar with. And oftentimes, I just gave a talk on an article that's been around on the website for a long time on fear and meditation and anatta, and how that process is a natural process of awakening. Oftentimes, that unnerving experience is fear. Do you want to, and again, I'm not prodding you too.
Yeah, no, but I'm fine talking about it. The last talk that we had this morning, I kind of, well, I guess all the talks this weekend have been leading to more clarity for me around ignorance, specifically. And I was reading through the book, and there was a question that I haven't asked for 3 years. Finally decided to ask it. Careful what you wish for. But the question was around dependent origination and the final link around dependent origination, which is the resulting stress, dukkha, sickness, aging, death, and all of that. And the question that I had was always, so the first noble truth is there is stress. And at the end of dependent origination, there is stress. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to undo the links to eliminate the stress. So it was like there's two different types of stresses that are happening. There's a stress that we create at the end of dependent origination through our own self-identification. And we're working to eliminate that. But then the question was, so we still have this other stress though, right? Like that you're just never going to get rid of because it's just the stress of the world, right? And then in talking with John through that, what I also realized, and what you helped me realize, was that what the Buddha was also looking for was elimination of all stress, right? So in that, there's an elimination of, where I took it was, there's an elimination of stress, like, I'm going to live this life. If I can overcome my self-identification, when I die, I'm eliminating stress. There won't be another continuation of that energy, of that negative energy, of that stress that I'm carrying through the world. And when I realized that, I went, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I had this moment that was really uplifting, because I said to myself, well, if I can eliminate stress associated with dependent origination, I can live a full life. And when I die, if I've been able to eliminate that during my life, then ultimately it's eliminated. Like, stress has been overcome. Mm-hmm. Like, the
task is done.
Truth of stress has been overcome. And so I felt great. I mean, I was sitting there eating lunch and I couldn't stop smiling. Best thing in the world. And then I came back here and I took a nap. And I woke up and my ego took over somewhere in the nap. I don't know where. And I was terrified. Terrified when I woke up. And I went, oh my God. And I recognized that it was my ego had jumped in and said, well, so if you overcome stress and then you die and then you overcame stress, then what happens to you? And I said, oh man, wow. So I kind of sat with that a little bit, and what I realized was that I kind of came back to the teachings, really. And what I realized was there's a sadness in that, in understanding and realizing that overcoming that stress, there's still the stress of the world that remains behind. And ultimately, when this body passes away, that's it, you know, which there's a peace in that, and for me there was also a fear in that, because once I pass away, then that's it. And I realized, though, that regardless of whether that's it, it's the reality. So life is stressful. The reality is that there will be stress. So I can make a choice to either live the way I've been living and further that stress through my own actions, or, and this is the part that John helped me with because I was getting really kind of nervous, or I can choose to stop furthering that ego and reinforcing it, and ultimately, with whatever time I have left in this world, really fully engage with it and fully enjoy it for every moment and everything that it has to offer, which means disappointment and also joy. And since those are the only two choices, I think to me, I was like, well, we'll go with this one. So at the end, you know, with John's help, it was to overcome that fear, which is really just my ego flaring up and saying, I don't want to go away. Just stick with the practice, because you've got two choices. And for me, the choice seems clear. So, anyway.
Thank you so much for that. That's literally true in each moment. We have only two choices: to become awakened or become more ignorant, or increasingly more ignorant, really. And the ultimate choice is, do I want to awaken before I can't awaken? Or do I want to just continue to ignore that? Even ignore that. Now we know it. You know, this kind of blows the illusion that you even have a choice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because you realize you don't. It's your choice. You've got to awaken now before it's too late. Take to it like your head's on fire. Kevin, please.
Is it accurate that the sutta is describing the unraveling and the five clinging aggregates?
Yeah, exactly. We become disenchanted with each one of the aggregates.
Mm-hmm.
And in that disenchantment, it's really not even accurate to say they fall away, except that's a good visual. There's no more influence by them because there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
But are they still operating, but they're not influenced by ignorance?
Yes. Yep.
And so they're, thinking and intellect, like when you said, become disenchanted by intellect, and I understand that, you know, more and more that it's the ignorant intellect, intellect born of ignorance,
yeah.
and recognizing that and abandoning that, we got to have intellect that's wise intellect. So yeah, like that's a good choice, right?
Well, and again, think about the context. It's only a self-referential ego self,
mm-hmm.
anatta, that which is rooted in ignorance, that could be enchanted. There has to be something created, conditioned,
mm-hmm.
to become enchanted.
Mm-hmm.
With nothing conditioned, there's no possibility for enchantment,
mm-hmm.
including the intellect. So the Buddha was completely disenchanted with the intellect, and yet he proved to be the world's greatest thinker.
Right. Clear. Very clear. Yeah.
This keeps coming back to the mindfulness of Bahia. With the unraveling of the sixth sense base, and that consciousness at the eye is a flame, consciousness at the ear, consciousness at the nose, consciousness of touch, the body, and that what's seen is only what is seen. What's heard is only what is heard. There's nothing that's it's not landing on anything that's interpreting it in a personal way.
Yeah.
It's not landing on consciousness at the ear, at the eye, contact at the eye, consciousness at the ear, contact at the ear. What's coming in through the senses isn't landing on something that's me, a personal thing.
A thing to create an attachment to it.
A thing to create an attachment. A thing that has an opinion.
Yeah.
A thing that has a, you know, the intellect that is managing that isn't managing it from ignorance.
That's brilliant. It really is.
He said the wisdom to depersonalize.
Yeah,
experience.
That's a great way of putting it.
That we have the wisdom to guard the sense gates.
Yeah. The wisdom to not take anything personal, because nothing is.
It's like you turn in your Velcro suit for a Teflon suit.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Good to go.
Nothing can stick. who is the famous, the Teflon Don? You know, nothing stuck.
But, I know for me the ego still, like, wants.
Maura, could you sit out a little bit just so I can see you, please? I just want to gaze on your loveliness. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin.
But that doesn't, like, that's, it feels like, well, that can't make any sense. I can get the eye, the ear, the nose. Like, a little bit with sight, because it's a little scary. It is a little scary, like, for somebody who, you know, I'm definitely enchanted with visuals in their eye. It, you know, it's threatening. It's not like we haven't heard this a thousand times again, too much. Like, I can feel that. I was kind of like, I wanted to talk to Liz about that, because Bonnie was another member of the Sangha that's an artist, you know, has some really interesting conversation around, like, I know Liz and Bonnie had that conversation about, like, how does the art change as a result of disenchantment. So it's a sticky little thing, like, yes, you just keep doing it and have faith. And you can't imagine it because the ego is filtering what it thinks is going on. I don't know. So that's all. But the intellect part was the thing that was, okay, I was like, okay, I can let go of that, let go. And then, but the thinking would be just clear thinking.
That's all.
Filtered through ignorant self that has a gain that's selfish in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The difficulty in that is it really is this, all the things that are pointed out that we cling to, including the aspects of the five clinging aggregates, it really does come down to we are so enamored and enchanted by our own thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and whatever thought arises, no matter how ridiculous it might be, we're enchanted with it. Why? Because I thought of it. It's my idea. And we've gone to war over ideas, haven't we? You know? And we go to war with each other over ideas. And what are they? It's an idea. It's ultimately what we're doing is coming to the recognition that the problem is my thinking. And the problem is because my thinking is rooted in ignorance, I can only create ignorant thoughts. And that one thought follows another ignorant thought follows another ignorant thought. It's almost, when I say it that way, I realize it sounds so, almost so heavy and so awful. But remember, there's nothing there. Ignorance relates to nothingness. I mean, not a nothingness in a mystical sense. Ignorance is nothing. It's nothing. False knowledge, you know, even though it seems real. Even though the products of those wrong views seem real, there's nothing there.
Question, John. I think it was day one when you read the Loka Sutta. There's a paragraph in there that pertains, I think, to what we're talking about, but it says, becoming anything other than self, and then I wrote in as a reference point, the world clings to becoming, is afflicted by becoming, and yet delights in that very becoming.
Yeah.
Which, to me, sort of personifies, you know, it's anthropomorphizing this thing that is there, but it says, and yet delights in that very becoming. Did I already read that? Anyway.
Yeah, but read it again.
Becoming anything other than self as a reference point, the world claims to becoming, is afflicted by becoming, and yet delights in that very becoming. Where there is delight, there is fear. Where there is fear, mm-hmm. there is stress.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tease out where there is delight, there is fear?
Yeah. Because I'm the one that's almost always reading it, it's just marvelous to hear it read. I got to do this more often. Because I am now delighted with the world, with what's occurred. I also can generate an underlying, even subconscious fear that can overwhelm me, because I might lose what I'm now delighted by, what I've attached myself to. And it leads to this underlying stress. You know, think about the brilliance of this man 2,600 years ago that identified that underlying stress of fear that's always present once we become delighted with something, we attach ourselves to something. Because we also know, and we've had the experience of losing the things that we love the most, whether it's a piece of chocolate cake or a baby, we've had that experience. It's a common human experience. And because we've delighted in it, attached ourselves to it, created an identity to it, there's always that underlying fear. And what is the practical occurrence of that? It's taken all these years for medical science to find out the most debilitating condition in the world is stress. And we have such a hard time even identifying where is stress coming from. There's been endless studies about how do we even understand stress.
Mm-hmm.
Stress is that underlying fear that's caused by delight. And this incredible man pointed it out 2,600 years ago. Thank you for bringing that up and asking me to hash it out a little bit. And it really was great to hear somebody else read it. I hope that doesn't sound like a complaint. But it's the words, hearing the words that way, are so incredibly inspiring, aren't they?
There's something odd here. My late mother-in-law, good old girl from Bristol, Italian, she would actually go around and say things like, I don't really want this because I really like it. And I know that everything I like is just going to, I'm going to lose it.
Yeah.
And she would not delight in anything because she was afraid that, I mean, she actually spoke of that fear.
She couldn't enjoy a moment of her life because of it.
She couldn't enjoy it. And she was kind of seen as crazy. But she just basically brought out what the human condition is.
Yeah. She was so affected by it.
But she didn't know what to do with it.
She didn't know what to do with it.
She
didn't know how to find relief from that stress.
And the difference is the Buddha saw the futility in it, and it all. All of that is dukkha. Especially when we start delighting in it, or becoming enchanted, or attaching ourselves, or defining ourselves, or joining with it, which is another way the Buddha described it. We join with dukkha. Larry.
Yeah, and one of my earlier experiences with this and this very subject, this isn't what I was going to say, but this is really cool. It is this attachment, and it was my realization that this is my delight, my car, my house, my children, my wife, my money. And I had this realization that I'm sure came with some help from others, but I don't remember when that was, but it came to me that I absolutely had nothing. None of it was mine. None of it was mine. The best way I could describe it, because of course this is all very hard to describe, it's hard to put into words, but it was there, was that the best way I could describe it
if I attempted to, was that I have a temporary use permit for everything.
That's right.
And I have a temporary use permit for myself. I have a temporary use permit for everybody in this room, for my money, for my car. It's not mine. I just got this temporary use permit. And when I start looking at things like that, I value them in a different way, but they were enough, you know. That
yeah.
It was just, you know, when you were asking, what, how does that feel? I can tell you how it feels. You know, I can talk about, you know, something, I can tell you how this feels. And there's a feeling of comfort. There's a feeling of relief. There's a feeling of release. There's this. I mean, I was a self entity swimming in a sea of self entities, and I wanted to please those self entities, and they were probably wanting to please me, and it was, you know, talk about on fire, and I couldn't do this. You hear that? Those are dry hands. I never had dry hands. And years into this, I started realizing, oh, my hands are dry now. Because I was so nervous, I was so stressed. Mm-hmm. And it probably stemmed from what you're going to think about me. And I remember that getting to the point where I much didn't really care what you thought about me. I mean, you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And
not in an arrogant way, it just didn't matter.
Yeah. And so... I just thought I wanted to get that up because it's actually a tangible thing.
It is. You know,
it's very, it's not just understanding the Dhamma, which is a beautiful thing, but it's actually the result of what one gets from that.
Yeah.
Is that thing we were talking about too the other day, is enough. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing beyond.
Anyway.
Thank you. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. You are now Anna Larry. I'm just you know, I'll speak for the.
I know.
You're close.
I'll
say, Larry, I think I'm speaking for everyone. I'm so glad you joined our sangha.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Don't let that go to your head.
You can't.
I don't really care what you think.
Now he's in.
Yeah, he really is.
He can sit right in front of John. Employee of the month.
And I will say that even though I have had that, this is so wonderful because it's so much clearer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why it's so much fun. That's why we laugh so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely one of this gang of misfits, boy.
I find that in the absence of eye making, there's humility. And
absolute humility.
Humility is actually a really wonderful feeling.
Right? What is the root of humility? Is humus. It means be down to earth.
Yeah.
To really have your feet on the ground. Yeah. And that's the essence of an awakened human being. It's true humility. Knowing who you... Another perfect interpretation of humility is to know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Not who you aren't and have to present that.
Right.
You're nothing that you're not anymore.
Yeah.
True, thank you for bringing that up. It's true humility.
Yeah. A page marker on that word.
Oh, and I don't know, I'm getting carried away now. I just want to, you know, what Matt said about nothing to land on, I just really connected with that too, because one of the things that used to occur when this was coming was another word, judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, you realize, gee, I'm just not really judging.
Yeah.
I mean, it's another tangible outcome of this work, is that it's just natural.
It is. Lorna, you were talking about that earlier. You just don't judge things anymore.
John and I were sitting just outside. In the sun, and I said,
I was listening to you.
No, copy
your notes.
Delighted with your guys.
Not judgmental in my mind, and not judgmental when I'm here. That just like fizzles out, it just floats away somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm not judgmental here.
It's the true integration. When it becomes a part of you.
Yeah, the freedom of living within the framework of the Eightfold Path leads to lightheartedness.
It does,
embodiment.
I like to call it the Alfred E. Newman syndrome. What we worry?
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.